Evening, everybody. Welcome back to That's Criminal with John Stamp. Before I get started, real quick, spoilers. Thank you, everybody, who has been so supportive of spoilers joining Audible. I can see it, you know, in the comments I'm getting and the feedback that all of you are throwing my way. Chaz Mandala, you guys seem very happy with the way he put that spoken word out. I thought he did a great job, and the comments I'm getting back, you guys are pretty happy with them too. So big thanks to Chaz, and thanks to you for all the support you've given me so far in spoilers first week on Audible. And I will attach a sample to the backside of this this episode. So keep an eye out for that. To get into it though, tonight we're talking to author John Mattinger. John Mattinger's law enforcement career spanned 35 years as a narcotics investigator and a U.S. Treasury agent. John joined the drug war in 1974 as a sheriff's deputy. He served as a narcotics agent, supervisor, and special agent with the IRS before retiring in 2010. He spent 15 years of that time in undercover assignments from Florida to Honolulu. He worked major fraud and money laundering cases, becoming one of the country's leading authorities on money laundering. He holds a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Indiana University and a master's degree in history from the University of Hawaii. As far as books go, he's written two textbooks, Confidential Informant, Law Enforcement's Most Valuable Tool, Money Laundering, A Guide for Criminal Investigation, two novels, Death on Diamond Head and Pipe Dreams. He also wrote a history of the opium trade, Opium Kings of Old Hawaii. He's received awards for fiction, nonfiction, short stories, and poetry, which is something we got to talk about. I do not have a poetry gene. His most recent book is a memoir, Going Under, Kidnapping, Murder, and a Life of an Undercover, released September this year by Wild Blue Wild Blue Press, my publisher. He currently lives in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, with his wife and a Portuguese water dog named Indy. John, thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, I had to look up what a Portuguese water dog is. I was like, what is that thing? I was like, I have no idea what that is.
But, great dogs.
I'm a dog guy. Very cool. I will say to start out, Going Under was a great read. You know, the way you start out, and you kind of bounce back and forth episodically as it goes. The characters along the way, it was fun to read, from, you know, Birdsong to Lieutenant Grimes to the psychics, it's a great journey walking through your career. I had a ton of fun. Made me think of things that compared to when I was running the street. It was a blast to read. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, sure. I had a great time writing it, and there were some really interesting characters. It's like you in law enforcement, man, you just run into people all the time, different, unique, interesting characters. And some of them are good, some of them are bad, but they're all pretty much interesting. It makes a great career, you know?
Yeah, great careers, great stories. I also really liked how, you know, people always think that we have to be in opposition to the criminal element, and that, you know, because they're bad guys, they get treated like bad guys. But, you know, just because you're breaking the law and have to serve when you're finally caught, you got to go do the time for it. It doesn't mean there can't be sometimes it seems like you had a camaraderie built up with some folks. Like you were able to communicate, and you could see how when you interacted with these people who were on the wrong side of the law, you did so by treating them like a human, just one human trying to help the other human, working together. You didn't have that conflicting good guys, bad guys theme.
Yeah, narcotics is different, man. It's one of those things that in working dope, you, especially if you're undercover, you know, you're really running with the pack there, you know. And I said, somebody asked me what it's like, and I said, you know, it's you're the sheepdog and you're running with the pack of wolves. And so you get into their, you're kind of into their lifestyle, into their lives. And even if you're not undercover, and I'm sure you know this from your experience, even if you're not undercover and you're working narcotics, you still work with those people as informants and witnesses, and they're part of your case. And so you spend a lot of time with them as people, and not as with patrol, for example, where you encounter some guy and he's a crook, and that's your experience with that guy, is you're arresting him for the violation. You don't know anything else about him. You don't know him or his family or anything like that. But with narcotics, you get much more intimate. You know, you're much more, you spend a lot more time with these people. And so, yeah, I think you do get close to them in some cases. I mean, you can't forget who's who and what side they're on, but you do get a lot more intimate and personal, I think, with those kind of cases.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you spend hours, you know, whether you're wiring somebody up, debriefing them, proffers, all that stuff. You get to, you know, especially court, if you're sitting there sitting with them at court because they're a witness or something like that, that's, you get to know them and you feel
right.
For them.
Yep. That's right. You know, I mean, it's a matter of, if it comes down to sides, you're on one side, they're on the other side. But in narcotics cases, a lot of times you're bringing those people over to your side, at least long enough for them to betray, I guess, their associates. And so, you know, you are kind of on the same side for a little while.
Yep. Yeah. Not always the most trusting of sides, but yeah, you know, no. Business is business.
No.
And yeah. So as I was going through it, what to jump off with was, you know, you start out with I keep trying to call it Frogmore. What is it? Frog Pond or Frogville?
Frogville, right? Frogville, USA. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you laid it out. It laid out, when I was reading it, I was like, he's laying this out as a Western. You know, it's like one riot, two Rangers, you know, and Grimes. Right.
Well, it's a weird case though. And, you know, unique because it wasn't my thing. You know, I wasn't there. I didn't do kidnapping investigations or homicides. I never did those things. I don't have any experience, or I didn't have the jurisdiction either. I mean, it wasn't one of those things where this is definitely an OBN case, but it was about dope. So that's how I'm in it. But yeah, so unique. And that one of the reasons why I wanted to feature that story in there, the other reason, of course, being Pat, was I wanted to feature that story in the book because it was so different. You know, it was totally different from anything I've ever done before. And of course, all the people are just as weird as they could possibly be. So I didn't know who to trust or who to believe, or weird situation.
Yeah, it's you know, especially outside of your beat, like you were stationed in Oklahoma City and you were way out towards the Texas border. And it's funny, even, you know, you run out to, and I've, you know, I wasn't out chasing a kidnapping, but just going out and working on an allegation someplace an hour or two away from your duty post, you have no idea who you're talking to, but everybody in town knows exactly who you are. So
yeah,
the dynamic.
Especially in a little town like that, you know, they all knew who we were right away. And they're telling us, and the other thing that was strange about this deal was, everybody was telling us you can't trust the sheriff, and he's the local law enforcement in that neck of the woods. You're supposed to be able to go directly to him and talk about the case and figure out how he wants to deal with it in his county, you know, especially in places like Oklahoma, where they don't want the state poking around in, you know, in county city matters. They want the state supporting those law enforcement agencies, but they don't necessarily want you running in there and telling them how to do their thing, which we tried not to do. But in this case, the sheriff was dirty and they eventually did convict him. So it was one of those things where we're kind of on our own down there, the two of us down there, trying to figure out how to deal with this thing and what to do, get this kid back.
Yeah, it's a weird feeling, but it's so law enforcement. You know, everybody always thinks that everything's planned. We've got intel. We know where we're going. We know what we're doing. And what was it? Your boss was just like, "Hey, you're going to Frogville, and you're going to solve a kidnapping."
Yeah.
What? I'm going to what?
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to go down there and help at the highway patrol. They're doing a kidnapping. And I'm like, the highway patrol, they don't do kidnapping cases either. What are we getting into? And it wouldn't have been my deal anyway, because that part of the state was Tulsa. Our Tulsa office handled that eastern part of the state. And so, but they were busy doing a clandestine lab case. In fact, it was the same case I told you about earlier. And They were busy doing that. So I just get like, well, you're not doing anything important. Go down to Frogville. Where?
We'll figure it out. Make your way and figure it out. But yeah,
I've had a couple people contact me since the book came out and said, well, I read the book, but he said, I had to stop. Two of them said this. I had to stop in the middle and go get a map and see if there really was a Frogville. Yeah, there really was a Frogville. There really is.
I didn't get caught on the name of the place, but I kept getting distracted, trying to figure out what a frog eating a bird would look like.
Yeah, me too. That's weird.
It's such a small. It was such a small, interesting detail, and it feels like Grimes was just messing with you the whole time. But I'm like, man, that's a big frog. I'm like, that'd be yeah. something to see.
it was probably a small duck, but
yeah, yeah, a duckling, but it was a baby, yeah. But it counts. It's still a bird. And yeah, so we, you know, bouncing from that story, moving on to something else, and then coming back around to it, just kept everything moving. I know there's a name for it as far as story structure, but it just evolved. And like you said, it was such a weird case, and everybody, I don't want to give anything away, but basically, and I'm not kidding, Hatfields and McCoys of Oklahoma are opposing pot dealers or growers, and young McCoy goes and tries to rip off the barn of the Hatfields, and they decide to kidnap him.
Right.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he was a pot raider, and that's how I wound up getting involved in it, was because it was all about marijuana.
Yep. And so he gets roughed up, and then you basically just had to work the town without the assistance of the sheriff to resolve it. And it got crazy into like immigrant laborers and lynchings and talking to old man Hatfield and seeing if he can come off with it or something. That's like, man, but it got a resolution. So that was a good one. It was just very entertaining to pop back into that little situation. Be like, oh, okay, here we are. We're caught up. Let's see what happened to Tommy, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And through that, well, you know, these interspersed stories with all these different characters, you know, I'd like to talk about Jimmy Birdsong, but I noticed, and you mentioned it, I mean, you're right off mentioning it, that the tactics that you guys used back then, nobody would ever approve now. Like you just, like sometimes your boss, now you got a fistful of money in your pocket. You just go make a quick buy, come back with a warrant later. No ops plan, nobody, no backup. It's
nope. No. And you know, what happened was enough people got killed doing that. Enough undercovers got killed doing that, that finally they figured out that, hey, dudes, this just isn't worth it, you know, to go out and get basically killed for a minor amount of dope or even a big amount of dope, you know, it just wasn't worth it. And so undercover, they've made some restrictions in federal, especially the feds, but everybody else too. And it's exactly like you say, they don't do that stuff anymore.
Nope.
And, I went out a lot of times and bought, because they gave me, Oklahoma issued me $200. I had 200 bucks and I could ask for more and get it and I never had any trouble getting it. But I take that 200 bucks and I could pay informants with it. I could go buy dope with it, whatever. And a lot of times I had no backup at all and nobody witnessing the buys, and you know, if something had happened to me, somebody decided they wanted to rip me off or whatever, and that I talk about that in the book, but you know, there wouldn't have been much I could do about it.
So, yeah, and
totally changed. Took all the fun out of it. But it's a lot safer now.
Yeah, and it's funny as you well, it's not funny, but you can see that trend throughout. You know, as law enforcement developed, it went from, you know, the 1800s, the Wild West, you know, one riot, one ranger, like I already said. And where I've seen it, you know, the evolution of our tactics, the evolution of our profession, is it's always starkest to me when we get, you know, whenever you go into basic training and you're getting your legal lectures and all that court precedent, you know, building on privacy and, you know, evidence rules, procedures, Miranda, and you can see our profession build from you're the bad guy, I'm the good guy, I'm going to go arrest you and the court's going to believe me, to this guy got a lawyer, he figured this one out. Oh, okay, we got to change tactics. Time to change tactics again. Miranda rights, who knew, you know, and we got to change. And it's just the same thing happens with us. That's how we got SWAT. And that's how, it, you know, when I was, I already told you, I was not meant for undercover work, but whenever we would send somebody out to do a buy, there'd be four or six of us out there scattered around, all mic'd up already, you know, just to have that kind of backup because nobody could operate. You know, there's no way anybody to prove us to operate like that.
Right. Yeah. Yep. It's, they realized that it took them a long time and it took a lot of dead undercover, really quite a few dead undercovers, DEA agents and state agents, city. And, you know, it was like, hey, it's not worth it. The risk is just too high.
Yeah. But it's understandable. Also, I mean, when you're, you know, mid 20s and wearing a badge and gun, you already think you're a little bit invincible, you know, up until you hit something hard, you know,
a little like bit, race you're convinced driver. Nothing bad's going to happen. Yeah. I mean, we used to tell ourselves, you know, and we tell this to the undercover that was going under and say, hey, look, no deal's worth getting hurt over or killed over. This is not worth it. Not worth dying for. You know, don't take the kind of risks that would put you in that situation. But we all did anyway. Yep. And, you know, it was like, yeah, nobody's going to kill me for my buy money.
Yeah.
Even though I've seen it happen. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It always comes back to the adage of the race car driver that everybody's fast until they hit the wall really, really hard. Right. And yeah. Unfortunately, that's the way we learn. But I did, make a note, speaking of the just the dangers that you faced, you had one set in a book, and forgive me if I give too much away, but you had one instance where you're staring at your own grave that already dug for you.
Yeah, they pre-dug the hole.
How do you process that?
Those guys were just going to rip me off. They were just, it was just, let's just take this guy's money. And yeah, that's a really hard thing to face up to, because even if you get away with it, which we did, by luck mostly, you know what? You don't look at something like that and go back to it and say, hey, maybe I'm not as invincible as I thought. You know? Maybe bad things really can happen to me. And you don't go away without thinking that, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you...
And see, so you would set up the buy off a couple of guys through a source, correct? And then right. It, you know, it just so happened that you had backup and you're like, I'll go with you too. So it just happened. Now, it's not like you guys planned to go with two of you. You know.
Yeah. You know, what happened was I would have gone alone. I normally would go alone in undercover. I usually didn't take anybody with me. But this was going to be a buy bust, and the boss said you got to take somebody with you for this, especially since we're doing it at their house, which I also didn't like to do. So I said, okay, well, you know, and I would normally have taken my partner. I wouldn't take Jimmy because Jimmy Birdsong was there with me that day, because guy was really super noticeable. Everybody knew him, and you know, as an undercover, you try to avoid people that might know that you're a cop, you know, running into those people undercover is kind of a bad scene. So I wouldn't have taken him, but the boss said take him. So I did. And that was kind of what put them off, was because they didn't know how to handle two of us. But the informant said, he's like, I think they still would have tried, though, you know, after they saw Jimmy. Wow. I think they still would have given it a shot.
Didn't give him a chance. And those of you, Jimmy Birdsong is described as 6'7". The Rooster Cogburn, except not quite that old, kind of.
And the guy was a legend. I mean, he was a super guy and a great agent, but he was like a legend in Oklahoma. I mean, that when you're a legend, that means that everybody knows you, you know? So you got to be kind of careful about what kind of roles you put him in. And the two times that I went with him, both of them wound up being really weird, eerie kind of coincidence, same kind of situation. And each one of them was strange for different reasons, I guess I should say.
Yeah, it was, as I was reading that, I'm like, how long can a 6'7" dude do undercover before everybody in Oklahoma City knows exactly who he is?
About 10 then, minutes.
Yeah, but I also read like 6 pages further and the guy's like, hey man, I arrested you last year. How did you buy dope for me?
Yeah.
it takes all kinds. Yeah. So you started out as a deputy in Indiana. I was wondering, so you grew up in Hawaii. How'd you end up in Indiana?
College.
Okay.
Went
away to college. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And was law enforcement always a plan, or was it, looking for a job?
I was going to be a lawyer when I went away to college, and then decided I liked law enforcement idea better. And Indiana had a criminal justice program. So that's when I went to IU.
Yep. Yeah. I always wanted to be outside. So I was like, well, law enforcement is probably the way to go. Always outside doing something. You have no idea what it's going to be. So I'm like, perfect. Yeah. Perfect for me.
See the world, meet interesting people, and arrest them.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yep. Yeah. You never know what's going to happen in the middle of the night. That's the best time to be on patrol. So there you went to Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics, where you were, that's where you're stationed with the Hatfields and McCoys drama. Right. And then from there, the Treasury. So you went to the IRS?
No, actually I went to, I was with Oklahoma OBN for 2 years. And then I joined I got hired by the state narcotics in Hawaii. So okay. I was with them for 10 years. So, and I got burned out on narcotics. I was about 13 or 14 years in at that point. And I just was like, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, I mean, it's like pointless. And I just didn't like the associations anymore. And I just wanted to do something different. So I was looking around, and DEA had offered me a job, and but I would have had to move to Los Angeles, and I didn't want to do that. And so IRS was hiring, and they said, you can do money laundering cases for me. Okay, well, that sounds like something different. You know, I'll try that. So they hired me on, and they immediately assigned me to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, which is where I was working dope for another 15 years. So just be careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah, right. But I mean, with the attacking the money laundering side, if you can't stop the dope, at least you can take their money from them. I mean, that.
Yeah. And the money laundering thing was really interesting because it didn't have to be narcotics. It could be money from some other crime. And I eventually did get to work some fraud cases and some other crimes behind the money laundering, which was good for me. I learned a lot and got involved in international training and was and taught money laundering all over the world. And so it was a good experience for me. Worked out, really made life much more interesting. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Getting the government to send you around the world is it's a lot cheaper that way. You get to see some cool places. Yep.
Yeah.
I always,
never send you any place nice. They never sent me any place really nice. But I saw a lot of the world, so it was good opportunity for me.
Yep. Yeah. I'm thinking about it. I'm like, yeah, that's true. We don't get the garden spots. Yeah.
Yeah. They never sent me to Paris or Nice or someplace that tourists normally go. So I did go to Africa. They've been to Africa a bunch of times and got to go on safari. So that was cool.
Yeah, I hit up Africa too. Didn't make it to the safari, and I was in the desert part. Were you in the green part or the dark or the brown part? That's how I divided it.
Yeah, I did east, west, north, and south, basically all over Africa.
Oh, nice. I loved it. I loved it there. There's a vibe about Africa. I've told my wife and my kids that at some point we're going back to see the continent. I only got to see a little sliver, but I got to go back some point.
Yeah, if you get a chance to go back and get on the and see what Africa's known for. I mean, the safari animals and the landscape, and that's really a good experience.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is a very interesting place. So working the difference, one of the reasons I mentioned the money laundering side is the difference. How did things change over time between, working street buys and then facilitating money laundering? Did you do the undercover stings where you were facilitating money, taking in money from the bad guys and making it look like you were washing it?
Yeah, I did that. Yeah. Well, that's the thing that's changed the most, really, money laundering. When I started out in 74, 76, money laundering wasn't a crime, right? It wasn't illegal. So obviously the people didn't really, it wasn't a factor for people, for crooks. And it wasn't a factor because at that time, you couldn't seize stuff like cash. Now, you could only take the car if the guy brought the car to the dope deal. You know, you could seize the car and forfeit it because they had transported the narcotics in it. But seizing cash was really, really hard. In fact, when we would seize cash, we called the IRS and had them come down and do a termination and jeopardy assessment on the money that we'd found. And they would take all of the money that they could for taxes and to give the rest of it back. And you know, that just obviously wasn't satisfactory because the crooks were keeping all of the stuff, the profits and stuff that they were making. So in 86 and 88, they passed the amendments to the drug laws that allowed for the first time the government to seize the cash, the proceeds, the profits of narcotics. Well, then if you know that the government's coming after your money, you're going to try and hide it. Well, that's when money laundering became an issue. And that's when they passed the first money laundering statutes. So yeah, it was it went from being no problem, money laundering being no problem, to now it's like an international industry, man. Both sides, anti-money laundering and the money launderers. And it's probably one of the biggest businesses in the world.
Yeah, I can tell you where I'm at now. The demand for that kind of training is far outshining most of the other curriculum that I see.
Really?
So yeah, it's just the demands, international. Like you said, there's some countries whose entire GDP is based on money laundering and being a shelter, So it's
another issue that I discovered when I was doing the international training was that in the United States, most of the money that gets laundered is probably from dope, right? It's going to be a drug. That's where the real money is. But you go to some place in Africa, some country in Africa, I won't name any names, but you pretty much most of them, the real money that's there to be, that needs laundering is the money that they steal from the government or they steal from aid packages, So the people you're training are a lot of times in places, third world places, people that you're training about money laundering are the people that are actually doing it. So you got to be careful. We have to be careful about who we teach this stuff to.
Yep.
I joke a lot about my book, which is Money Laundering, a textbook, which is used by the Justice Department and the Treasury Department and a lot of foreign countries too. I joke about it not being a handbook on how to, a how-to guide to money laundering. It's not supposed to do that. However, you cannot teach this without teaching people how to launder money. So you got to be careful about who you do it to.
yeah,
you don't give the money to.
In some countries, it's one of the most coveted gifts, your book on money laundering.
Yeah, yeah. I got a call one day from a customs guy. This was when I was working in Honolulu. And he said, hey, we're out to a search warrant on this guy's house. And he had a copy of your book. And I said, did I sign it for him? I said, oh, did I sign it for him? He goes, no, I don't see it signed. I go, well, okay, well, he's a customer. Hope he's a satisfied reader.
Yeah. Does he want an autograph?
I didn't offer that, but.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, I didn't come on until the 2000s. So by the time I showed up, we actually had a guy that did, you know, facilitated all the stuff. So if we identified something, we turn it over to them and they process all the forfeiture and all that stuff. It was such normal. It was just a way of doing business. I can't imagine what it must have felt like. You know, you're in, you know, 10 plus years into your career, and suddenly you realize that I can steal the bad guy's toys. Like, were you guys all sitting around when that came out and we were like, oh, we're going to have some fun now?
Well, actually, it went back to all the way to college, because when I was at IU, my professor said, I want to teach you the financial investigative technique. And that wasn't the subject of the class, but he said, this is the way that cases are going to be made in the future. And I was like, dude, that really makes a lot of sense. You know, we should be going after these guys, looking at the money as the first. So I did that from the get-go. When I started Oklahoma and when I was in Hawaii, I was like, forfeiture, we got to go after forfeiture. We got to go after the resource, go after the money. If we can't take it, we get IRS in here and get them to take it, but somebody has to take it. We cannot leave these guys with the profits of their crime, or they're just going to keep doing it, you know, and beating us up. So for me, it was from the very beginning, it was, let's go after the money, go after these guys' money. And it's funny, because now it's like you say, now it's, you got to have that in your investigation, any kind of investigation where there's profits involved, man, there's going to be FBI or DEA or Secret Service, any of those guys, they're going to be looking at that and see if there's some way we can clean these people out. And that's the way they should be. You shouldn't leave them with two nickels to rub together if we can avoid it.
Yeah. Anybody can do a few years in prison if they know they got a couple million dollars waiting for them on the outside.
And I've had people tell me, you know, just I'll go do the time, just leave me my stuff. Sorry, it doesn't work that way anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Spoils of the crime. These are my toys now.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Well, when I was a narc, my car was a forfeiture car. It was a little souped up Honda that I absolutely loved. Nobody wanted to drive it because it was, you know, purple, but it was a purple little Civic that was a rocket ship. And I was like, why don't you guys want to drive this car? This thing's awesome.
Yeah.
I didn't mind at all. It didn't sound right when there was country music blaring out the windows, but that's, you know, it's my car, my rules.
Yeah, I drove a C's Corvette for a while. It was a nice car, but terrible police car, but a good ride to be cruising around in.
Yep. I wasn't transporting anybody in that thing, but also I could blend in anywhere. So that just became my thing. Whenever they offered me a new car someplace, you know, especially if I was an investigator, I wanted the dumpiest, most beat up vehicle that they had. And it's, you give me that thing, I can go anywhere and nobody's even going to look.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did. So there was a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. The book was, I'm sorry, when we start talking about money laundering, it just, I wanted to get your take on it. Cause like you said, that's always been part of the gig, and being there right when it got codified must've been cool. But that professor, I mean, what was that guy had to have had a background to be like, he had to have been an investigator or something.
Yeah. He was thinking about the techniques that IRS used to get Capone and the other organized crime people back in the 30s, which was basically a financial investigation. And it was a really, at the time, it was a forward thinking concept. It wasn't something that people were doing, but he was right. You know, he's right. IRS didn't get, I mean, the the feds didn't get Capone for all the stuff that he'd done. They got him for taxes, and they did it with a straight up financial investigation, and basically a net worth case. And it's extremely effective to do it that way. I did a case in the early 1980s, before there was a money laundering law and before there was the real forfeiture statutes that kicked in. I did a case involving a Quaalude dealer in Honolulu. Major investigation, guy was a major violator. It was the first continuing criminal enterprise case in Hawaii. And we did a net worth on the guy. And the funny thing was, is it was a multi-defendant conspiracy case. It was like seven or eight. And one of the guys severed out, so he got tried separately. And the rest of them got tried together, the mastermind and his wife and about five associates. And the jury acquitted the five associates, and they convicted the main guy and his wife. And I talked to one of the jurors afterwards and said, hey, what was the deal? You know, why did you, I thought the evidence is pretty good. You know, why did you? And he goes, well, you had all this information. You had all this evidence about how much money this dude made. And it was clear that he was, you know, made a couple million dollars selling Quaaludes. And we had all the expenses lying, all his expenditures, everything that he'd spent money on. We had all that information on him, but you didn't have any of that for the other guys. And I'm looking at him going, dude, you know, they're like low-level dope people. They don't accumulate $1 million. You know, they put it in their arm or put it in their nose or whatever, but they don't do that. They buy toys and lose them and buy more dope, you know. And the reason that this guy had so much money, because he was smarter than the average bear, and he, you know, and we did the financial case to prove it. But for me, that was just validation. Hey, this shows how effective that tool is.
Yep. And yeah. For every one of them.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's yeah, just the, you know, the guy that can, the guy with the discipline is the one that wins. That's yeah. Just all it is.
Well, yeah. this guy was a retired Air Force colonel. Ooh. And so he knows discipline and organization, and he was a smart guy.
Wow, that's quite the retirement gig for a Air Force colonel. That's a whole different way of doing things. Man, so I wanted to ask about that, professor, because that's just what a great way to set a student up for a career, is to just have them start thinking out of the box right from the start. Yeah. And it was
it made an impression on me, and I was careful to follow the stuff that he taught us. Don't learn much in college, but I learned that much. So
yeah, get the piece of paper, get the job.
good advice. Yeah. Follow the good advice.
That's awesome. Back to the book, you had a section in there about your weird tricks when it came to serving search warrants.
Yeah.
I've seen the insurance will cover it. I've seen the car accident one. The, dumping a pail of water under an apartment's front door was I hadn't thought of that.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
That's pretty fun. Yep. I was chuckling when I was reading it, because we were sitting around the office one day, and I'm not going to tell war stories, but it just occurred to me when I was reading that for years. We were sitting around the office one day trying to figure out what to do, and the radio's on. This is back, everybody, when we actually listened to the radio. Did not listen to podcasts like That's Criminal. Uh-huh. And so the radio comes on, the DJ kicks off a contest name, like somebody's won a radio contest. And we had an outstanding warrant for a dude who'd been kind of skipping us here and there. And but we had numbers for his girlfriends and his mom and all that stuff. So we were just like, hey, why don't we try that? So me and one of the other detectives, we just start calling. Mom, we call girlfriend, we call brother, blah, 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 blah. And we're asking, hey, you know, this guy won a radio contest and this is his number he left. And on the third one, he's like, oh yeah, yeah, what'd I get? It's like, oh, it's five grand. And he's like, oh, awesome. You know, where are you? We'll come and we gotta have you sign for it. And he tells us exactly where he is, comes out to meet us, all psyched. And it was right. Just once we pulled the badge out, he didn't even fight. He was just like, oh, he's like, man. it was so defeating. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of those, but it was funny. You're, the, Have the manager go to the door, having the insurance will cover it. I didn't notice though, like you had a website where they explained all those search warrant tricks. You found a site based on that?
Found a site. No, I don't remember that.
I thought in the, you mentioned in the book when you're talking about your tricks that it was before. Now there's a website that explains all the different ruses that people use. Maybe I missed that.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah, no,
it was just, it caught me funny. It was very entertaining for me. Those little pieces.
I hope not. I hope there's not somebody out there saying, well, here's all the tricks the cops use, but there probably is.
Yeah, between Reddit and Quora and all those other things, I guarantee there's something out there. but no, that entertained me. It's but the pail of water under the door and telling them they had to evacuate for a flood. That was fun.
Yeah, I don't like the new technique now is basically just to kick the door down and run in there, you know, with guns blazing and hopefully not blazing, but drawn at least. And, you know, you tear the guy's place apart to execute the warrant. I always felt like, man, it's like, I don't want to kick the guy's door down if I don't have to. And I'm going to try and eliminate as much risk as I can. Why don't I just see if I can get him to come to the door, you know, and answer the door.
Yeah.
People do that normally. So let's see if we can get him to do it this time. So I always found that was better than this whole SWAT thing, you know, and like no knock warrants. Did you ever do one of those? I didn't.
Yeah. We did a bunch of no knock warrants, but it was always, there had to be stipulations of, violent background or, you know, multiple felonies, you know, resisting. If there was that, we'd hit them, but the whole tearing a place apart, most of the time we need those guys to work with us. So, you know, if I'm sitting there taking a knife to a sofa, he's going to be pissed. That damages the poor real quick.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing, you want to try and work with the guy. Hopefully, unless it's one of those deals where you're at the top of the ladder already, you're going to want to go one rung higher. So, you know, you're right. Do you want to like trash this guy's house and make, you know, lay waste to his whole life? Or can you find a little bit more mellow way to pull it off? You know?
Yep.
Yeah. I think that was my attitude toward it.
Yeah, going in with sugar over a cudgel seemed to always be a quicker way to get a source. Just seeing somebody watching you tear up their place, it's like, this is not, we're not doing it right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was the weird tricks and serving the search warrants and extenuating the police into pleas was that was pretty entertaining.
Warren. Yeah. Open the door, Warren. Please, Warren.
That? Yeah, what was the best reaction you ever got to that? Like just completely just I lost. Just some seeing that
scene. Always the same, you know, where they would come to the door and say through the door, there's no Warren here. And go, Warren, come on, Warren, open the door, please. And you know, eventually they're gonna open the door and say there's no Warren here. And so that's when you tell them there is a warrant there.
Yeah, it's right here.
For coming outside.
But don't worry, I got it right here.
Yeah, I have it here someplace.
Yeah. So that was a good one. I also and stop me if I'm giving stuff away, but there are so many of these fun tidbits, and I'm not even touching the surface of them. But your tarot card interrogation was masterful. Flipping the
It was one of those things where and you've been there, right? You're trying to establish rapport. Wasn't even my case, you know. This was a military case, and I forget, I think it was Army CID, but might have been the Navy. But it was their deal, but because she was a civilian, they needed some civilian law enforcement present because of posse comitatus, right? So we assisted them a lot on different cases, and we went out on this one. And so I'm working with, I'm trying to work with her. And like you say, I'm trying to develop that rapport, get her to come around so that if they decide or we decide that we want to use her as an informant, she'd be willing to do it. But that was the purpose of Dan. I want to be all mean and nasty to her and try to find some rapport. So it turned out she was a psychic and she knew the psychic that I knew. And so we had something to talk about. Worked out nicely, but weird how that happened, huh?
Yeah. That sequence of cards that you got her. Yeah, I mean, it's reading the book. Yeah. I could just sit there. Like I could see just whoop, whoop. And then the last one just shake. Just, you want to see this one? Nope. I sure don't.
No, she did not want to see that last card. And I don't know, maybe she knew what it was already. I don't know. Maybe that was one of those psychic things. Yeah. She knew it was going to be, it was kind of prophetic.
Yeah. Yeah. But unless the stress dampened her psychic abilities, you never know. She might've been hitting a block.
You never know. Yeah. Yeah. It could be.
It's just that it's funny. I just that was entertaining to me. It's just, you know, oh, okay. I'm going to break you. I'm going to break you with your own tarot cards. Watch this. Yeah. So I don't want to give away too much of Going Under, your novels, set in Hawaii, crime noir, crime thrillers. I haven't gotten to those yet. I was focused on Going Under.
Yeah. The first one was Death on Diamond Head. I wrote that as kind of a beach read for people. It's just a basic mystery story. But you know, it's a fun book. If you want to write, you can read it on the plane going over to Hawaii or the plane coming back good story. Just a typical mystery, I think. But Pipe Dreams is really interesting because that book I did, that's about the Massey case in Hawaii. And people who aren't familiar, the Massey case was a huge deal, murder case in Hawaii, another lynching. And was a young Navy wife that had been claimed to have been sexually assaulted by a bunch of, by five Hawaiians back in the early 1930s, and caused all kinds of problems between the military and the civilians in Hawaii. And I actually knew somebody who had perfectly involved in the case, knew the victim. So it was kind of interesting to hear from that perspective about the case that everybody in Hawaii knows about this case. It's one of those things that's, it's like everybody knows, even almost 100 years later.
Yeah.
Because it was such a massive, massive problem in the 1930s for Hawaii.
Yeah, I can imagine that kind of just applying that to a novel. I'm heading for Hawaii later this year. I'm going to bring at least one of those with me. A long flight. It's a long flight.
Pipe Dreams is a better book. Dreams is a better book. It's a very, it was fun because it was one of those things where I grew up in that neighborhood and I knew some of the places and some of the people. In fact, the previous owner of our house was a foreman on the jury
on
the murder jury. So it was kind of, there were a lot of personal connections to it. It was a good book, good read.
Yeah. Especially when you can tie, you know, real history into that fictional story. Just, yeah, that's great. Which leads me, did you always want to be a writer? Like, was that always in the back of your mind? Like, I'm going to do this law enforcement thing. I'm going to get out and tell my stories
No, but you know, what's really strange. And you were just talking about it a second ago. I was talking about the psychic. Well, there was another psychic story in this book Going Under. And I was talking to my wife and my sister-in-law about this, and they had gone to see this psychic, and I put that part in the book. Mm-hmm. And my wife said, who hasn't read the book, by the way, we'll see how long it takes her to do that. And she said, did you put in there that the psychic, who I call Lynn in the book, that Lynn said that you were going to be an author, you're going to be a published author? And I go, no, I don't remember you telling me that. And she goes, oh yeah, she definitely said that. And I'm thinking, well, that's freaking weird. How strange is that, huh? The psychic telling us that. And I hadn't really at the time, this was back in the 80s, I hadn't really at the time thought about being a writer. And I didn't really think about it until I wrote the money laundering book. And I wrote the money laundering book as a textbook for the training that I was doing, so that I'd have something standard that I could do for the training. But after that, I was like, well, okay. And I had a couple of publishers that were interested. And I said, well, what about, like, if I do a second book, will you take that one if you take this one? And they said, yeah, they would. So I got to do the confidential informant book. And after that, I was like, well, I think I'll do a novel.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, it was a good second career kind of thing, even though you can't make any money at it, as I'm sure you're aware. The author business.
Yeah, we're artists, right?
Yeah. It's hard. This is hard. It's a business, and it's a hard business.
Yep. So, yeah. It's a hard business.
Unless you're Michael Connelly or John Sanford or James Patterson, you're way back there.
Yeah, it's an interesting gig to try and break into, and like when we were talking earlier, I started writing to have fun, and then I figured out the rest as we go. But the 100,000 words is easy. It's then they expect you to sell it. I'm like, what? Huh? Isn't that what you guys are for? No. Okay, I'll do it. Yeah. Let me figure out how to do this. So that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't mention Lynn the psychic, but since you brought it up, that did go into, she did fall into a case somehow. So the question when I was reading was, so we're putting this case together. The informant wants to run things by Lynn. At what point did you have to tell your partner and be like, I don't know if we can go see the psychic because I've seen her before, that's getting personal.
Yeah, we were, well, it wasn't that we believed this stuff, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, do we believe that she can really tell if you're an undercover agent by you just walking in there but the crook is telling the informant, he's going, you need to go. You too need to go. The informant who brought the undercover agent in and the UC, you guys need to go see Lynn. And if she says you're okay, then, we'll go ahead and do the deal. And we're like, well, we don't really believe this stuff, but how do we say no to the guy? How do we say, we're not going to go to Lynn, And if we go to Lynn and she says, no, you're not really an undercover agent. Well, what if she tells him something different, right? Or what if she says, you guys are cops, or you're a cop and you're helping the cops. What if she tells the crook that? Well, then they're both burned, obviously. So, we were like, no, man, there's just no way we can go do this.
Go ahead.
Sorry. And the other thing was, this chick was pretty good, and based on what my wife and her sister-in-law had experienced, she got almost all of it right. How the hell did she do it? She knew stuff that even my wife didn't know. And she was telling my wife about it. My wife's going, well, that didn't happen. And I'm going, it did, but how does she know that? So, it was really a conundrum for us about it. And so we finally just we let greed take over. We moved it up and said, hey, we don't have time for it. It's going to happen tomorrow or the deal's off. And the guy just got greedy and went for it. And that was how we got around it. But I don't know. I don't know how we would have handled it if he had said, I'll wait and see what happened. And she might have told him, why did he get all crazy in the first place? Why did he want to see her in the first place? Maybe she had told him, hey, these guys you're meeting you're going to meet a stranger who has a badge in his pocket, but you don't know about it. And
there's a dark aura over you.
Yeah. You're going to die in prison, which is, if you do a deal with this guy, you're going to die in prison, which is what happened to him. So
you can't escape destiny, apparently. See, I was under the impression when I read it, I thought it was one of those things where the wife made you go see her on date night. She's like, you're going to a psychic, yay. So I was under the impression that she had seen you before. And I was like, that's going to be an awkward conversation when we're doing the
opposite. Yeah, no, she hadn't seen me. She just saw my wife, but, and her sister, but, But I mean, everybody in Honolulu knew her, love her, you know, and there were so many people. She was busy every day at her place. It was really she was really well known.
Well, it's good business if you can get into it. I guess you got to have a track record, though.
She had some kind of talent because she sure got a lot of stuff about me, right?
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. That's very interesting how the personal life kind of just weaves its way right into work and you're like, uh-oh, that's a problem. But, I don't want to keep you too long, but given your background, your 35 years in law enforcement, if you were, you know, lecturing a group of kids today, what's the advice you got for people who want to be cops today?
Oh boy, that's a tough one because things have changed so much since 1976 and everybody's got a camera these days. So you're constantly under scrutiny that we didn't have to deal with when I was starting out. I mean, it's a little better because you're not in uniform. You know, they don't know until you badge them or whatever that you're a cop necessarily, but tough decision to get into. And you know that the legal requirements and the legal ramifications for doing things have changed so much now that when I started out, our manual was like this. Now it's probably like this, you know. I mean, all these new rules and everything. I mean, FBI, when I started out, I think their operations manual was like one or two, three-ring binders. It's probably nine now.
Yeah. You know, when I was there was two of them. They, was it the MIAC and the MAIAC or something ridiculous like that? It's those little, like the Bible paper smashed into those little binders. It's like, what?
Yeah. But now it's probably all on computer and it's probably like 10 terabytes, you know, of stuff that you have to remember. And if you screw up, you're going to get fired. And yeah. So, you know, it's tough and it's a tough, different world. And if you're imagining that it's anything like TV or any kind of historical basis, I don't think so. I think it's now today, it's much more bureaucratic, much more consequences of things are more certain, you know. And not that it's necessarily a bad thing. We want people to be accountable, but God, it is. Yeah, you make one little mistake these days, it's going to be on film and it's going to be in everybody's living room in the next 10 minutes. And you got to deal with that for the rest of your life. So, I mean, that I think I would go into it with a very clear idea about what you're facing. That'd be my advice, would be to go into it with a very clear idea about what life is like today in law enforcement.
Yeah, I'd still think it's a gig that's probably more fulfilling than many others, but I would take some real scrutiny and study the government of the city. And I would probably take a real big look at the actions of leadership in any given department that I was going to join. I would really make sure who's the priority before I jumped in anything these days.
Yeah, there's some towns. There's just no way I would work in Baltimore or Minneapolis, even Atlanta after that guy shot that dude with the taser. Yep. I mean, that was a good shoot in any country, in any city in the country until, you know, they charged him with felony murder, for God's sakes. Yep. I mean, holy, I think they've dismissed those charges now, but I mean, if you're going to go to work in that city, how do you go to work the next day knowing that you did everything exactly the way the rule book told you to, but they're still charging you with felony murder, capital crime in Georgia.
And even when you get out of it, you're still a villain to 80% of the people that you saw simply because of the media. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, to me, that's a real, that you're exactly right. You're exactly right. I would want to know a whole lot about the people I was working for before I joined a police department today.
Yep. Yep. I think it's a great gig, but I would definitely make sure I knew which way my leadership was going to bend.
It can be very rewarding. You know, I think it can be a very rewarding, like you say, it's a career that has those kind of benefits, you know, that you feel like you're doing some good and keeping society from self-destruction.
It's a hard one. I like asking it because there's no easy answers anymore I won't keep you too much later tonight, but do you have any socials, any sites, any place we can send people?
Well, my name is my website, johnmattinger.com, and of course Wild Blue Press is the publisher there.
Yeah, I liked the videos. I liked you had a couple of YouTube videos up there when I I like those.
Obviously got too much time on my hands in retirement.
Wild Blue's really good about getting us out there, like giving us some platform, which is good. Yeah. So going under Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the regular places,
and of course Wild Blue. Get it directly from the publisher.
Yep.
So yeah.
Awesome. Well, I thank you very much for joining me tonight.
No, it's my pleasure, man.
Absolutely. And everybody, before I sign off, don't forget, I'm going to load a sample for spoilers on the end of this. So thank you. And we'll talk to you next week.
Max, Banks, and Viejo mounted rickety old wooden stairs, which cracked and popped under their weight. Thompson, after sprinting from the apartment perch, fell in behind them. In approaching the door, each member of the team covered a different field of fire. Viejo was on point, carrying a battering ram. The two patrol units pulled up in front of the house, and the officers dismounted to provide perimeter security. Viejo paused at the front door. Thompson locked eyes with a perimeter unit before turning and squeezing Banks's shoulder. In sequence, Banks squeezed DiGello's shoulder, who in turn squeezed the shoulder of Viejo. Viejo grinned. "Police! Search warrant!" Viejo yelled. When Viejo hit the door, the heavy iron battering ram struck just under the doorknob. The door was ancient, its brittle wood shattering under the impact. Viejo backed up a step and hugged the wall of the tight porch. Max charged the door and hooked to the right. Banks was second in the door and covered the left side of a small living room and set of stairs leading up that side of the house. Thompson smoothly cruised past Max and Banks and made his way further into the house. He and Max cleared room by room as they went. Banks held his position until he felt Viejo behind him, and they made their way slowly up the stairs. "Police!" they called at random intervals. "Show your hands!" Banks and Viejo mounted the second floor and quickly secured the upstairs. They reached the final room of the second floor and yelled, "Clear!" signaling they had found nothing. The two detectives looked at each other before filing back downstairs. "Quiet in here!" Viejo's comment froze in his throat as a sudden crashing sound rattled the house. "Shit!" Banks breathed. "Coming down!" he yelled as the two men ran down the stairs. Banks hit the first floor after leaping the last four stairs and landed with a boom on the warped old wood. He could hear breaking furniture and shattering glass coming from a room to the rear of the living room where they had entered. He and Viejo were steps from the doorway when two figures burst from the room. Banks was just a step too late for the first, but the second was just a step too late to get away. Banks threw his non-gun hand out and caught the fleeing suspect with a clothesline and dropped the man to the floor in a huff. "Police!" he shouted. "Don't move!" He locked eyes with the suspect, a kid maybe in his 20s. He was white, wearing checkered shorts and a polo that could only be described as the brightest orange he'd ever seen. Banks put the muzzle of his .45 in the center of the kid's chest and ordered, "Don't move!" But he knew even before the kid flinched that it was on. The briefest of flashes behind the suspect's blue eyes telegraphed what was to come. The kid roared and swiped at the pistol. Banks yanked back to protect his gun and had to duck and block a wild punch with his non-gun hand. The kid scrambled to his feet like a cornered animal and took another swing at Banks before breaking for the rear door. Banks gritted his teeth, and just before the kid was out of reach, lashed out with a front kick to the small of his back. The boost in momentum carried the kid off course from the freedom he was willing to assault a police officer for, and he ran smack into the peeling paint and wood of the doorframe. The impact stunned the suspect, and he crumpled to the floor, holding his hands over his face. Blood bubbled through his fingers. The kid moaned as he slowly rolled into the fetal position. "I bet that hurt," Banks said. He yanked the suspect's hands behind his back and handcuffed him as the kid howled. A quick pat-down revealed a quarter of an ounce of what looked like weed and a handful of pills he figured was ecstasy. "You sit tight," he told the kid, and left him to wallow as blood streamed from nose and split lip. Banks looked out the rear door to see if the other suspect had gotten away. He chuckled when he saw the kid, another white kid dressed much the same as his compadre, except wearing a pink polo shirt, lay sprawled on his back as if he were in the process of making a snow angel. He looked unconscious. Poppy and Wilkes stood over him. When Banks looked at her, she shrugged her shoulders while cradling her Car 15 as if she'd just found an abandoned puppy.